This is Writer's Voice. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
You know, so then the question is, the really extraordinary timing of taking the one guy who could get in the way of the bailout and knocking him out the day before you do it.
That's investigative reporter Greg Palast. We'll talk to him in the first half of our show.
We all lead interesting lives. We just need to find out what's interesting about them. And if we can, you know, corner that part of our life, we have an interesting story to tell. And that's enough.
And that's author Lou Jurenik. He'll come up in the second half when we visit the Nieman Conference on Narrative Journalism. Today, we talk to journalists. Later on, we'll travel to Boston and the Nieman Foundation Conference on Narrative Journalism. There, we'll talk with speakers like John Hockenberry, organizers, and participants. But first, when Elliot Spitzer was brought down by scandal, a lot of people wondered why it all broke then, when federal prosecutors had known about his libidinous peccadilloes for months. That's something my next guest, investigative reporter Greg Palast, has an answer for. And he says it all has to do with the current bailout by the Federal Reserve of the banks behind the subprime mortgage debacle. Palast reports for the BBC and other media outlets, but before that he spent years investigating financial crimes for federal prosecutors and state's attorneys general. So the world's touching on the Spitzer scandal and on the much greater shenanigans of Wall Street speculators is very familiar to him. Bill Bowie of Corporate Watchdog Radio joined me as co-host on this interview. We talked to Greg Palast earlier in the week. Well, Greg Palast, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Glad to be with you, of course.
The rumors have it that Wall Street cheered when they were told that Elliot Spitzer was going to resign. And when I read that, I thought, okay, it's schadenfreude. You know, they're happy at his pain because of the tough time that he gave them when he was New York's Attorney General. But you say that Wall Street had more to cheer about than just schadenfreude, that Spitzer was about to go after them.
Yes. In fact, on February 13th, he was down in Washington to announce that he was launching a whole new attack, Governor Spitzer, on the mortgage banks and on the investment banks that were ripping off America and warning that we were heading also towards financial collapse. That was the evening that, of course, he decided to relax with some illegal takeout. Now, the boom was dropped on Spitzer the day before the biggest bailout of banks in American history. $200 billion was dumped out of Federal Reserve vaults and into the hands of the 20 largest commercial banks in America. And that was just the beginning. And so it was the very next day. You have to understand that there was only one major politician in America that would have stood up against that, and that was Elliot Spitzer. I mean, it's the most miraculous timing on the planet, but the one single guy who made it his personal crusade to stop this bailout in advance was Elliot Spitzer. He goes down, and the next day, the bailout goes ahead. Now, you can make of it what you will, but I did work for U.S. prosecutors, including one who liked to run around recently saying, Florida is Rudy country. And I can tell you, I have never been involved in a prosecution, a federal prosecution of just some John. It doesn't go that way. This is a question of prosecutorial discretion, and their discretion was to nail Elliot before the bailout. That's what happens. And people have to understand what it was that Elliot Spitzer was blowing the whistle on, and you don't hear the whistle blowing. The $200 billion is going to the very people who have been destroying this economy. But we are going to see 2 million people this year lose their homes. 2 million people are going to lose their homes to foreclosure. Spitzer was trying to prevent this by saying, this is not the action of people who just didn't have enough money or borrowed over their heads or any of that baloney you hear in the paper. This is about illegal, predatory lending practices against the laws of the state of New York. And he was going after George Bush. He actually called George Bush a criminal co-conspirator with the predatory banks. That's quite a charge, and he had the legal muscle to back it up until
they got him. They busted him. Well, you know, let's give us kind of the Cliff Notes version of what these predatory lending practices consisted of, and then what Fed Chairman Bernanke did this week. So let's start first with what happened beforehand, what led up to this, and then what the response has been.
Okay. What we've had is a regulatory striptease. And let's go back a bit. When we had the Great Depression, similar games being played. Franklin Roosevelt shut all the banks, shut every bank in America. It's called a bank holiday. And then agreed to bail them out, but he said under one condition. You're going to do it my way, the public way. From that point on, banks had to maintain certain financial controls, had limits on the amount of interest they could charge. They couldn't do gambling and banking at the same time. They called that the Glass-Steagall Act, investment banking, which is basically high-class gambling, and commercial banking, which is, you know, keeping your pennies in the bank and lending you mortgages, were two different businesses. And by the way, that glass wall was shattered by Bill Clinton in 1994 for the benefit. The number one beneficiary was Citibank. Two days later, Robert Rubin, the Secretary of Treasury, became a chief executive of Citigroup Corporation. So it started with Bill Clinton, but it was accelerated massively by George Bush, who allowed predatory lending practices to not only thrive, but become the rule, so that it wasn't just, you know, 1 in 100 people get stuck with some stinky, questionable, fraudulent loan, but nearly half of the loans in America were heading towards what are called subprime or teaser loans or whatever the heck you want to call them. Just so people understand what this is, a subprime loan is, first of all, it's I can tell you what type of loan you have by just tell me your race. I'll tell you your loan. 73% of all upper-income black and Hispanic borrowers were given subprime loans, that is, punitive interest loans. Only 17% of white borrowers. So that number was rising in the last year. So based on your race, you were racially steered into a higher-cost loan. But what they would often do, so you wouldn't even throw a book at someone or file a lawsuit for discrimination, what they would say, well, we'll start you out at 4%. Instead of a normal 6% loan, we'll start you out at 4%, but 2 years later, you got to pay 10%. They say, well, that's crazy. I wouldn't go with that. So don't worry, in 2 more years, we're going to give you a cheap loan again, so don't worry about it. Well, 2 years later, you come in and say, wow, I just got a bill. My monthly payments have doubled from $900 a month to $1,800 a month. I can't pay that, so I need that new refinancing. They say, aha, gee, we're sorry to notice the fact that your mortgage is now worth more than your home, because we didn't tell you that when we told you the mortgage interest is 4%. In fact, you were paying 7%, and we're charging now for the amount you didn't pay before. You didn't read page 272 of your mortgage agreement. So that's what was going on, and Spitzer said, that's illegal. One, racial steering is illegal, and the Bush administration stopped him from investigating racial steering. Two, mortgages where you're teased into it, sucked into it, with a promise of that your rates will always be low, that's fraudulent lending, that's bank fraud, and he said that's illegal under the rules of the state of New York, and the Bush administration moved in and preempted him using federal law to stomp on and prevent the enforcement of state law. And understand, the reason they hated Elliot Spitzer is that every bank has its major operations in New York City, which means that they are under New York state law. So the Fed said you can't impose state law on nationwide banks. And that's why they fell in love with the Bush administration and hated Elliot Spitzer.
So, Greg, you're pointing out a number of really social justice issues here. You're pointing out how blacks and Latinos were steered into these subprime, really predatory loans. You're also pointing out how at the other end that the high rollers at the banks were getting this bailout, which really rightfully should go to the borrowers who were mistakenly or illegally steered into these loans. So what are the implications of this bailout in terms of these CEOs who recently testified to Congress justifying their really obscene payout over this?
Well, I don't know. I'm going to disagree with you. Anthony Mozzillo, the head of Countrywide Mortgage, which is a front organization for Bank of America. They are funded by Bank of America. Now Bank of America officially owns them. They issued 1 in 5 mortgages in America countrywide. Their CEO earned over $500 million. I don't mean for the company. He personally earned over $500 million. Now, someone who can rip off several million mortgage holders and get away with it, okay, deserves at least $500 million in pay. I mean, I think that Mozilla deserved more.
He's working for his money, huh?
Because, you know, I mean, look, class war, and who should get paid? The winning generals or guys like Spitzer who are the losers, the guys on our side? Okay, so let's remember, compensation is for what you accomplish. Now, compensation, we like to think in America, is for, like, doing a good job, you know, a nice banker who gives out mortgage loans. We all saw It's a Wonderful Life, which is about a credit union. If you have money in a bank today, in a commercial bank, anyone listening to this, stop being an enabler. Take the money out. Don't feed the sharks, okay, and put it in credit unions, which do not, by law, will not, and their regulators won't allow them to issue subprime, teaser rate, phony, baloney mortgages, okay? So don't give money to the enablers. Don't get mortgages from the sharks who will turn around and bite you. So, you know, we have to be very careful. We as consumers can take some responsibility here, too. I mean, Elliot Spitzer was trying to cuff these guys, but he couldn't do it. And now we have $200 billion going to the 20 largest commercial banks last week, $30 billion to guarantee the buyout of Bear Stearns by J.P. Morgan. And their stock just shot through the roof today as we're speaking. And now Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve, just appointed by Bush, and it was a very careful appointment, because Bernanke, as an economist, had made a big deal about how if he saw any financial problems, he would open the bank vaults. He made it clear that he was an easy cash lay, you know. He's a good lap dancer for the banks. They had the perfect guy. And he's now said that over the next 6 months, even unregulated banks, investment bankers, which are just basically casino operators and loafers, that these guys will all be able to borrow from the Federal Reserve, not you or me, but they will be able to borrow from the Federal Reserve to back up their investments in junk mortgages.
We're talking with Greg Palast, investigative reporter for the BBC, about the connections between the bailout of the subprime lending industry and the timing of the Elliott Spitzer scandal. Spitzer was just about to go public with a plan to charge those banking institutions with predatory lending when the scandal broke. Tell us, what is going to be the impact of this bailout on your average taxpayer, one, and two, on your average, like, small investor?
Wow. unless you're wearing shark repellent, you're pretty much doomed. let's start at the people who are losing their homes, 2 million people losing their homes. And there is, in all of this, unlike what Franklin Roosevelt did, which is it stopped the foreclosures, right? These guys are getting the money without, they get the money and the home. They get to take your homes and get the money. Okay, that's number one. Cities are being destroyed. Like, Cleveland is trying to sue these investment bankers. Again, they'll have to fight Bush, because if you have one house on every street that's boarded up by foreclosure, no house on that street is going to be able to sell. All houses will decline in value, which is a disaster for everyone. 14 million Americans now have houses worth less than their mortgages. I mean, basically 14 million people on a financial basis should probably just, you know, throw away the keys and leave. So what's happening is a huge loss of Americans' wealth. And that's going to have a huge impact on the economy, because as people feel poor, not just feel poor, but as they become impoverished in their personal wealth, they don't buy things. You don't buy a car if you don't, you know, if you're worried about paying your mortgage, it's going up.
Yeah, but Greg, you're talking in general about the impact of the subprime debacle. What about the impact of this bailout?
Yeah, well, I mean, the sellout has other impacts. One, it's rewarding people for being sharks. Number two, despite the massive amounts that are going into the hands of these predators, because you're not stopping the source of the bleeding, which is the destruction of the value of America's housing stock, it's going to keep bleeding, and they're going to have to print more and more and more money to give to these guys. In other words, if you don't stop the foreclosures, you're not going to stop the free fall in the value of U.S. housing. This is very, very important. And so you have to stop the foreclosures, and you have to do what Hillary Clinton say, and then finally Obama jumped in too, which is you've got to change the terms of these mortgages, which the banking authorities can do. That's what Spitzer was trying to say. You can't give someone a 4% mortgage and say, don't worry about the fact that it says it's going to 11% in 2 years. No, if you said 4% and then you promise that you'll give someone a loan of 4% 2 years later, buddy, you're going to give them a loan for 4% 2 years later. And that's what has to be the position. Now, as far as small investors, forget it, man. Don't even look at your little 401k sucker. I mean, the other people getting crunched are like towns in Norway, which bought up mortgages. What groups like Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns, J.P. Morgan, what these guys did was they bundled up these garbage mortgages. And once people pay out all their life savings, they have nothing left to pay, the mortgages, these predatory mortgages, are now worth very little. They packaged them up and sold them as securities to pension funds, teacher pension funds. European governments bought up tons of this stuff, and now they're screaming for their money, which is why, by the way, there's a run on some of these investment banks, because they're afraid the Europeans are going to come here and burn down the Bear Stearns headquarters.
So Greg, you've described how this undercut the housing market, how it's undercutting the investment markets. How about the idea of dumping, you know, basically printing cash and dumping it into the marketplace? What does that do to the value of the dollar, which is already in somewhat of a free fall?
If dollar values were reflected in a dollar size, they'd be like, you know, these little teeny weeny things. Yes, the value of the dollar is shrinking fast. And what that means is inflation. You know, the Federal Reserve, the way that they're for this, no one in Congress is actually voting to give these banks money. The Federal Reserve Board, without Congress's approval, can literally print dollar bills. Go into your wallet. What used to be called the U.S. dollar is really, if you look on it, says it's a Federal Reserve note. Ben Bernanke can literally take his little crew of guys and the 20 banks he works with, private banks, and say, okay, we're going to print up more money. They literally physically print more money. They just print it. And then they go and they hand it to these banks, usually through a complex transaction, which they give it to the U.S. Treasury, which takes its bonds and hands it to the bank, and then the banks hand their bond, their crap bonds, back to the Treasury. There's a lot of complexity to the actual motion, but it comes down to the Federal Reserve printing more money. If there's more money in a smaller economy, and those dollars represent your claim on an economy, you know, you can buy a loaf of bread, you can buy something with it. If there's more dollars out there, each dollar is worth less. By definition, it costs you more to buy anything. So we all pay through a very complex hidden tax for these bailouts. And of course, there's no disgorgement. In other words, when people do commit frauds or play games like this, you usually make them disgorge, as they say in the prosecutor biz, their ill-gotten gain. But no one is suggesting that Mozilla give up his $500 million. The guy from the head of Bear Stearns, the CEO, got hundreds of millions of dollars in bonuses just out of control. And while the world economic system was collapsing last week, he literally took time off to just to do a couple days of all-day bridge tournaments.
Wow.
You know?
We're speaking with Greg Palast. He's the author of Armed Madhouse, a longtime investigative journalist. Greg, a lot of pundits are saying that this whole bailout, while distasteful, you know, the words moral hazard have come up there, the idea that here we are, as you say, we're basically rewarding the guys who screwed up royally. But they're saying that it's distasteful, but it has to happen in order to prevent worse, that we can't afford not to do it.
You know, I've heard this baloney, and even, you know, Hillary Clinton's backing off, Obama is hiding, noting that his chief fundraiser is known as, Peggy Pritzker is known as the subprime queen, by the way. You know, you hear a lot about, by the way, all of Obama's internet funding. Mm-hmm. But the investment banks, these predators, are his biggest donors by far, overwhelmingly, have funded the campaign. They have also put in massive monies into Hillary's campaign and McCain. They're the new big bucks on the street, not used to be the Enrons, the power companies, used to be the oil companies. It's now the investment banks and these subprime sharks, because they know what they need to buy the White House to keep the game going. Do we have to continue to bail these guys out? Like I say, the way Franklin Roosevelt did it was, say, is a quid pro quo. We'll give you the money, but you're going to give us something. You are going to, number one, you're going to not foreclose on people. Number two, you are now going back under strict regulation. The casino is closed. Number three, we are restoring the glass wall, the Glass-Steagall Act, separating investment banking and commercial banking. We have to go back to the basic FDR principles of the New Deal, which grew this nation, and we are going back to a socialized mortgage market, which is what we had and made America strong and powerful. People came back from World War II, and our housing stock in America was built by loans from the Veterans Administration, and then later loans built and backed and tightly controlled under conditions set by the FHA and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which were government agencies. And basically, American housing was built by a socialized financial system in mortgage banking, and it changed. It began to change under Clinton. He took the lid. Basically, he removed the rules, but he maintained the regulation. That is, he kept an eye on these guys. Okay, he said, "Okay, we're removing the rules, but we're still going to watch." But once Bush came in, forget it, baby. Mozilla, Mr. $500 million, the front man for Bank of America, was allowed to completely run amok, and like I say, there was one single governmental whistleblower out there, Elliot Spitzer, and, you know, he's otherwise occupied.
Just to make it clear, Greg, you suggest in your article that this was a setup. You know, clearly Spitzer was acting on his own out of his libido, but can you just make explicit what it is that you're suggesting about Spitzer being a fall guy here?
Well, all I can tell you, one thing for sure, they couldn't have pulled this off if Spitzer were still in business. If Spitzer were still the governor of New York, and remember, he was kicking off a campaign. He had literally lined up the 50 attorneys general of every single state, Republican and Democrat. He lined up the banking regulators of every single state, Republican and Democrat, to back him on a charge to bring lawsuits, regulatory actions, and political action against the Bush administration and their complete negligence in the deregulation of mortgage banking. That's what he's leading the charge on. They could not have done this. They certainly could not have done this without giving something back, without saying predatory lending ends, etc. You know, so then the question is, the really extraordinary timing of taking the one guy who could get in the way of the bailout and knocking him out the day before you do it. Like I say, I worked as an investigator for prosecutors. I worked for 35 attorneys general. I worked with U.S. federal prosecutors. And I can tell you, I've never seen anything like it in my career. And I did that stuff for over two decades. I just have never seen anything like it. It really smells completely. And yesterday I found something else. One of Spitzer's targets, Ken Langone, a billionaire Republican, one of the big sugar daddies of the Republican Party. Spitzer charged this guy with conspiracy, with fraud, civil actions against this guy, insider trading, this guy had announced he's going after Spitzer. And yesterday he said, Langone, Spitzer's target, we have eyewitnesses that Spitzer was cashing money orders or obtaining money orders at check cashing places. Now, my first question, I'm trying to find Mr. Langone right now to answer a simple question. Were you, as a person charged with violations of civil securities law, were you stalking the prosecutor? Were you having the prosecutor trailed? Do we have obstruction of justice here by Republican Party funders who were targets of criminal investigation?
Wow. In the 30 seconds we have left, what is going to be the impact on the taxpayer? We're paying for a war in Iraq. We've got a huge bill coming due when it comes to global warming. What is the impact of this on the taxpayer, on the affordability for us to deal with the issues that are the crises that are facing us?
Oh, you got to give up on it. This happened with Reagan. We spent over $500 trillion bailing out the savings and loan when Reagan let them run amok. And that was the end of our social programs. Remember, Reagan's government wasn't tight-fisted. That's wrong. They spent money like drunken sailors just on their banker buddies. This administration is doing the same, and I do worry that even an incoming Democratic administration may not have, you know, they're already saying there's nothing we can do. We have to bail out these guys. I'm getting very, very wary of the Democrats being very timid about this story, because we're going to be paying this thing off for generations.
That was Greg Palast, investigative reporter for the BBC, talking to guest host Bill Bowie and I about the connections between the $200 billion bailout of the subprime lending industry and the timing of the Elliott Spitzer scandal. You're listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Next up, we go to a writer's conference. It's a Nieman Foundation conference on narrative journalism. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Next, we take a look at one approach to journalism by going to a conference on narrative journalism that took place in Boston the weekend of March 14th. We find out what narrative journalism is and talk to, among others, broadcast and print journalist John Hockenberry and also to Lou Urenick, author of the memoir Backcast. But first, we talk with Connie Hale. She's director of the narrative program at the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard University. The foundation puts on two conferences a year for writers and editors, publishes the Nieman Narrative Digest, and brings mid-career journalists as fellows to the center for a sabbatical to study narrative journalism. I called Connie Hale at her office before the conference and asked her to define narrative journalism.
Narrative journalism is basically writing which takes the techniques of fiction and applies it to nonfiction. So narrative journalism, the journalism part, implies that we're writing about important events, important trends, important issues of our day, but we're doing it through colorful characters, lovely scene descriptions, smart structure, innovative structure, classic storytelling devices like suspense and conflict and drama. But also, in my mind, narrative nonfiction implies that there's a narrator. And in most daily journalism, the journalist recedes from the story. The journalist isn't part of the story, and the journalist's voice isn't sort of as strong as a telling voice. But in narrative nonfiction, there's a sense of the storyteller.
Now, one example that comes to mind is you're going to have the speaker at this conference, and that's Alex Kotlowitz. Mm-hmm. He wrote about the projects in Chicago.
There are no children here.
That's right.
Alex is going to talk about the journalism of empathy, and I think I haven't heard his talk yet, but you know, he has some very interesting ideas about the way the narrative journalist relates to his subject and relates to his sources. So there's a kind of connection between the writer and the source that there may not be often in journalism. Another writer that we're having who, to me, really represents this idea of the presence of the narrator is Mark Leibovich, who writes political stories for the New York Times. And you don't usually think of daily political journalism as a place for a strong storyteller's voice, but I have the experience so frequently of reading a Mark Leibovich piece and not paying attention to the byline. I just look at the headline and I start reading the story, and I get two or three paragraphs into the story and I say, wait, who wrote this? Because there's a sense of a voice there. There's a presence in the story that's distinctive. And I go back and I look at the byline. Sure enough, it's Mark Leibovich. So that's part of what I'm talking about as the journalist, as storyteller. Even when you're writing about a campaign or an event that happened yesterday or last weekend, you write about it in a way that is rich with metaphors and imagery and the voice of the writer.
There are a couple of themes here that I'm picking up. One is that you have a richness of imagery. You have kind of a more depth or color or tone to a piece. But the other one is the relationship of the reporter to the subject. And that was very real in Alex Kotlowitz's book that I read, There Are No Children Here.
Mm-hmm.
And he also became involved with the family itself. I mean, he helped one of his protagonists, if you can say that, of the story, go to school, to a private school. So what does that say, and what do you think of? Do you think it's problematic to make more porous the boundary between objectivity, the so-called journalist objectivity, and the story?
Well, you know, the classic example, one of the early pieces of what we today call narrative journalism was Truman Capote's In Cold Blood. And the argument there was that he had become entirely too enmeshed in the story. But it was an incredible piece of narrative nonfiction. So I think there is this question. This question looms over all narrative journalism, and each journalist answers the question or resolves the dilemma in a different way. But that tension between, you know, that tension between who am I as the journalist, who am I as the reporter, and how am I to relate to my subject is something that's just a part of narrative journalism, negotiating that those boundaries and, you know, deciding how porous they will be or won't be.
And is it really a distinct field in itself, too? I mean, I'm just thinking here as you're talking, for example, of Edward R. Murrow, who mm-hmm. was a great, great journalist. I mean, would you really say what he did wasn't narrative journalism?
You know, narrative journalism, I think the reason you use the word narrative journalism is it has to do with storytelling techniques. Some journalism really is reported in the, you know, the classic style of reporting and writing in American journalism is who, what, when, where, why. You know, the why is part of the story, less explicitly sometimes. And the reporter is an objective, third-person voice or lens through which the story, you know, that observes the who, what, when, where, why. The narrative journalist has a different role. The narrative journalist is saying, what's the story here? What's the drama? Where's the conflict? Constructing the piece of journalism, I mean, just to explain, if you went to J school like I did, you learn to write a lead that's 35 words or fewer, and it answers the questions who, what, when, where, why, or who, what, when, where, and then the why is usually answered later in the piece, and you put the most important stuff at the top of the piece and the least important stuff at the bottom of the piece, and the reason for that is that the piece gets cut from the bottom when it goes into the newspaper. So there's a whole standard of organizing the information that worked in the newspaper format and that works when people are rushed and they may read the top of the story. You know, if they're really rushed, they only read the headline. If they're less rushed, they read the first couple paragraphs. If they're less rushed, they read the whole story. Well, narrative journalism is really different. It says, no, I'm not going to tell the story that way. I'm going to pull the reader in slowly through a dramatic lead that may take several paragraphs, and then I'm going to let the thing unfold in a whole different way. It's going to have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and the end is just as important as the beginning, which is very different from the way classic daily journalism is composed, is conceived, and written.
You know, it strikes me as you talk, I get the New Yorker every week, and I read it avidly. And, you know, there often the lead isn't even necessarily the most important thing in the story.
Right. And interestingly about the New Yorker, and this, if people do follow journalism and sort of know the classic formulas of newspaper writing and magazine writing, there's something we call the nut graph. And in a newspaper story, it's the second or third paragraph in which you tell the reader why the story is important. In a magazine, the nut graph might be further down. It might be a whole section. It might be the second section of the magazine piece. And the nut graph, again, says what the major theme of the piece is and why it's important. You can read a New Yorker story and never find a nut graph. In fact, I posed a question. John Bennett is an editor at The New Yorker, and at a recent conference in Berkeley, California, I said, where are the nut graphs? What happened to the nut graph? Does The New Yorker try to have nut graphs? It's hard to find them. And he said, we don't care about a nut graph. We care about a cosmic graph. And he defined that cosmic graph as that paragraph somewhere in the story where you get the sense of the bigger picture and the bigger context, but it might be very late in the story. So this is, I guess, you know, one sign of the difference between standard daily journalism and narrative journalism, that in narrative journalism, those formulas are opened up and far less rigid. And the most important thing is the sort of to find a spine of the story that makes sense and is excited and makes the reader continue reading, and to, again, find a character. For example, a classic technique of narrative journalism is to find one character through whom you can tell a story, because we love reading about other people. That makes us captivated. If we find a great character, you can often pin an entire story on one character, and that character's story tells the larger story. It's a really different way of thinking about conveying news and information.
And we're talking with Connie Hale. She directs the Narrative Journalism Program at the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard. Now, tell us about the theme of this year's conference.
Well, in the past, the conference has focused mainly on literary journalism, narrative nonfiction as it appears in print, and in particular, newspapers, magazines, books. There has been always in the past some focus on, say, photojournalism, but it's generally been the traditional forms of media, that, and there has been an emphasis on the literary, and in fact, a lot of the speakers have been literary lions like Norman Mailer and David Halberstam and Tom Wolfe. This year, we decided to really take a look at what's happening in our world, what's happening in our industry, and to grapple with the huge sea change that's going on in the journalism industry and in media in general. And that is that our traditional forms of journalism, and in particular newspapers, are being superseded by multimedia. A lot of newspapers are now telling stories through video, streaming video, through podcasts, through shorter stories linking to other stories, and we thought we really want to take a look at these changes and want to take a look at where narrative fits in this larger picture, in this larger media landscape. So the theme of the conference this year is storytelling in many voices, many media. Storytelling in many voices, as media proliferates and we get all these new ways of communicating, we have a lot of people that weren't traditionally, maybe not even in journalism previously, or new voices. And, you know, if you look at the blogosphere, you have a lot of people that aren't trained as journalists, and yet they're breaking news and making news and covering the news. We kind of cracked the program open, and we decided to insert a lot of programs that deal explicitly with questions about multimedia. It's a wonderful, we have a fascinating panel called The Power of Pictures, in which two journalists who were trained at the University of Missouri, which is a renowned school of journalism, one is a still photographer, one is a videographer. Brian Storm has a company called Media Storm, which produces wonderful essays that are a combination of still photography and recorded sound. Travis Fox does reporting all over the country and all over the world. He takes his video camera and he composes stories in that way. So we're going to put those two together with a TV reporter, Stuart Watson, who's a fellow here at the Nieman Foundation, and ask how you tell narratives, how you do narrative in these completely new forms.
And you have some broadcast folks there, too. There's John Hockenberry. And and what you're talking about also makes me think of something like Homeland Productions, which is produces wonderful, I guess, kind of narrative radio documentaries.
Mm-hmm. Well, John Hockenberry was, I think, a great choice for our opening keynote because John Hockenberry is someone who has been working in radio for, gosh, I think at least 30 years. But he's also worked in TV, and he has written a book, and he writes numerous articles for many top national magazines. So John Hockenberry is someone who, his entire journalistic career, he's been working in different media and has, you know, a very interesting way of looking at this. He has been storytelling in many media all through his career. And and he's done groundbreaking and award-winning work in these various media. So we're asking people like that to think about these new questions.
Well, Connie Hale, it's been lovely chatting with you about the Narrative Journalism Conference being put on by the Nieman Foundation. Thanks so much for talking with Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
Hale is director of the Narrative Journalism Program at the Foundation, and you can find a link to the organization's website at writersvoice.net. Now, let's go to the conference itself. Former Dateline NBC correspondent John Hockenberry gave the keynote address, and I caught up with him at the podium after his speech. I asked Hockenberry to talk further about an experience he'd mentioned during his talk. In this internet age, traditional media in both radio and print journalism are seeking new, quote, interactive ways of engaging with their audience, like having listeners and readers send in news tips or comment on blogs. Well, Hockenberry is working together with a New York NPR affiliate, WNYC. The station had asked Hockenberry to do an interactive piece on the current primary election season, and he ended up being surprised by what happened.
And we thought through what that would mean. I mean, and what we didn't want it to be is just a bunch of emails that we were reading. And in the course of thinking that through, at a time where we had, you know, almost no staff, we came upon this idea of creating a national exit poll, where we actually are interested in how you made up your mind to vote. And we think that story is a part of the kind of legacy of a democratic experience, be it an election, be it a primary, be it a caucus. We want to hear these individual stories and hear as many of them as we can. What we don't want to do is statistical sociology, where we're, you know, the soccer moms did this, or the, you know, other people are doing that, and actually that tends to dehumanize the information. We want to celebrate individual stories.
So what happened?
Well, we started to test with people who had already voted, anticipating that there would be a lot of interest in this on February 5th, the sort of super primary day. And we talked to voters and we said, so tell us how you made up your mind. We got them on the phone and they told us who they voted for. And they said, how did you make up your mind? And they said, well, you know, they talked a little bit like, Hannity and Combs or Chris Matthews or something. I mean, they talked like pundits. You know, they would say, well, healthcare is really important. And we think that, the security situation is really, really interesting. And I'm a Christian. I said, well, that's great. Thank you so much for that. But what I'm really interested in is, how did you make up your mind? What room were you in? What were you doing? Were you eating something? Who was in the room with you? And all of a sudden, the eyes light up. You know, they go, oh, well. And then all of a sudden, you know, the people that we were testing this on told us great stories about how they were going to vote for Obama. And all of a sudden, a three-year-old daughter comes into the room and asked a question about what it takes to be president, and I wanted to take her with me to vote, and I took her with me to vote, and so what happened, you know, and they told who they pulled the trigger for, and in every single case, the story was just like riveting. I was completely there with them. And even though it had no broad demographic significance, it really told a much more important story of how conflicted Democrats are about these two candidates, how difficult it is for people to make up their mind, and what a combination of issues, atmospherics, and personal details constitutes the ingredients for any individual vote. And that was beautiful. And the one amazing thing was that when we switched on the switch of where everyone could email or voicemail or text us when we were online live, you could see it happen. We aired, we recorded some in advance so that we could play what it is we imagined would be a great story. And we put a couple on and we said, we want to hear from all of you. You know, we want to hear how you made up your mind. Stories like this. And we played one or two of them. And all of a sudden, people got it. It was like we'd given them permission to tell a story that they didn't think anyone was interested in. They thought all we would be interested in was punditry, you know, them acting like Tim Russert or something. And in fact, we got thousands of stories of people who couldn't fast enough get to the phone to send us a message or to type us an email. Or it was really something. And so the whole narrative piece and the whole interactive piece was not about the technology. Wasn't about some internet tool. It was really about having the clarity of mind to realize that the most important information you were going to get was by delivering people the permission to tell a personal story about an event everyone was experiencing.
John Hockenberry is about to debut a new live morning radio show with co-host Adora Adoji. It's a collaboration between WNYC and the New York Times called The Takeaway. You can go to Writer's Voice for a link to more information about that. After talking to John Hockenberry, I wandered through the crowd on the way to the workshops. There I saw Julia Flynn Seiler. She's written a book called House of Mondavi. I'd seen her at a master class on memoir taught by Lou Jurenik and asked her what she had taken away from it.
Well, meeting Lou, our teacher, was an enormous pleasure because he's a delightful writer. And I was particularly interested because I'm starting a new book project, and some of my source materials are memoirs, which all have particular agendas. And so I wanted to discuss with him that question of how you weigh information that comes from memoirs. And I think what I took away from his advice, plus the advice of the group, was that as long as you're transparent, as long as you flag to the reader any qualifications you might have. In other words, if you say one person remembers it this way, another person remembers it that way, you're fine.
Lou Jurenik has written a memoir called Backcast. It's about a fishing trip he took with his son to Alaska and what they learned about their relationship. I sat down with Jurenik in a quieter room away from the crowd and talked to him about memoir. I started out by asking him about something that he had said in his masterclass. Lou, you were saying something about chronology. You had a very interesting comment. You said that you can begin at any point.
Right. Well, you know, everything has a chronology, of course, and when we're planning a book, we're planning the structure of a book. Principally, what we're working with is time, you know, a beginning, a middle, and an end. And the story is bounded. You know, it begins at a particular time and it ends at a particular time. And I wanted to make the point that time for writers is malleable. It's plastic. You don't have to begin at the beginning. You can begin halfway through and then flash back to the beginning. I think beginnings are very important. They grab the reader. They set expectations. They establish the tone and voice of the whole book. So I encouraged the members of this masterclass to look for interesting beginnings, and maybe they occur somewhere in the middle of the story, but that's fine. Find an interesting beginning, and then go back to the start of the story, then work your way forward.
You also, however, said that it's best to begin as close to the end as possible. What did you mean by that and why?
Right. I think a lot of writers have a tendency to clear their throats for pages and pages and to give us lots of good writing, but principally there is action in the story that is most important. It's what the book is about. And I think most of the time, most successful books begin as close to that action as possible. Readers, I think, want to plunge right into the action of the story. Once the action is underway, you know, the reader is engaged and involved and turning pages. Then we as writers can pause and go back and give some backstory, provide some exposition, description, and so forth. But it's action and story that holds readers.
Well, let me pose you a question then, based on, you know, give you an example and ask you what to do. What would you do in the case of a story that actually moves back and forth in time and in person? That is, you know, I heard of some of the participants who are doing memoirs that relate to their family or relate to family members. So they're writing about themselves as well as people in the past. How do you work out the kind of double narratives there?
Yeah. Well, you know, memoirs are told in the first person and from the point of view of the narrator, the writer. Now, you know, I think that we can consider something called what I would maybe a hybrid, a reported memoir, where the book is principally in the voice and point of view of the narrator, the writer. But we may want to go back in time and learn about family members 2, 3, 4 generations back, in which case we put on our researcher's hat and we learn everything that we can about them and we tell their stories. But we're still in voice as the narrator. We're not getting in voice and point of view of the other characters. That's really writing a novel and requires an omniscient narrator. Now, there may be some ways to do that, but it has to be very clear to the reader what you're doing. We don't want to pretend to know things that we don't know as writers in the first person. But yeah, it's an interesting exercise to combine historical research with memoir, and I think that's some of what you were hearing in the masterclass.
Now, here's another question. You said something about voice. Now, one could assume that if you're writing a memoir, the voice is a really easy thing. You know, it's your voice. What are some of the issues around finding your voice? What are some good ways of doing that, and how do you know when you got it?
Well, you know, we can all speak in different voices, and I think tuning the voice of the book is perhaps the most important part of engaging the reader early on. You want a narrator who the reader is going to trust, probably like. And this, I think, at least it was for me, was the most challenging part of writing memoir. I wrote the opening to my book, Backcast, probably close to 100 times, writing and rewriting and you know, tuning the voice so that readers were meeting a character who they would know and like. I wanted it to be me, but again, I'm many me's, you know, in real life. And I was presenting a particular me in the telling of this story. So the narrator in Backcast is a grown man who's been kind of beaten up by some events in his life, but is still hopeful, I think is likable, has a sense of humor, but he's a little scarred and barnacled in the process.
Now, part of so much memoir is kind of the tell-all. How does one separate out the authenticity, the willingness to be brutally honest if that's what's necessary, and just kind of laying out your laundry there in a way that's really is just a kind of a peep show?
Right. Well, I think a memoir has to be honest. We begin there. And I think if a memoir is not honest, readers will immediately smell a rat. I also think, however, that it doesn't need to be shocking and revelatory on the level of family dysfunction, drug addiction, incest, whatever. I mean, if that happens to be part of the story, and it is in some people's lives, you know, that's okay. But, you know, but that it doesn't need to be that. We all lead interesting lives. We just need to find out what's interesting about them. And if we can, you know, corner that part of our life, we have an interesting story to tell. And that's enough. But when we do tell that story, we want to be honest about it and candid. I think the reader expects that, you know, that of the writer, it's part of the contract. The writer writes an honest book, and then the reader is willing to pick it up, read it, and trust it.
Great. Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
You can find out more about Lou Jurenik and his most recent book, Backcast, as well as hear an interview with Nieman Foundation curator Bob Giles by going to writersvoice.net. Well, that's it this week for Writer's Voice. Please join us next week when we get a jump on Poetry Month and we also talk about The Illuminated Book. That's all coming up next time on Writer's Voice. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.